spreadsheet.
Six $100 between them, they had to pay.
That's about $50 a buck.
Yeah.
When? How long ago was it? Is it recent?
No.
No, it's been a good while. It was when Carswell was the judge.
Oh, that's right, you were talking about that the other night, yeah.
But Beattie had a good time, now if you think about it.
It was fun.
Well, I can't get over that catching the bus in Corsica. You all set the clock and then slept through it.
We slept right through it. Russell was so mad. She was just furious because she'd spent about 30 minutes the night before telling me how she hated to miss things. She hated to miss buses. She hated to miss trains. She hated to miss planes. Anything. And it upset her when she had to miss things. And I just said that it upset me a little bit, too, if I missed things. And if we missed this bus, it would probably upset us a lot because we couldn't get another boat to get off the island. So...
For the weekend,
that's right. Because we had tickets for Sunday to leave. See, there are two ports in Corsica. There's Bastia and there's Ajaccio. And Bastia is at one end and Ajaccio is at the other end of the island. And there's one highway that connects them. And there's only about one bus a day that you can get from one to the other. Well, when we went from Ajaccio to Piana, it took us 3 hours. And the distance on the map was about an inch. And to go from Ajaccio to Bastia is about 5 inches, so you can add up the hours that it would take you to get from Ajaccio to Bastia. If we missed the boat in Ajaccio, we'd have to probably go to Bastia to get another boat. So it was pretty important that we get that bus and get back to Ajaccio in time to get the boat on Sunday. And Russell set the alarm for 6 o'clock, and we both slept right through it. We didn't hear it at all. And later on, we used to say that the clock probably just didn't work. It probably didn't go off. That we were both neurotic about missing this bus, and we wouldn't have slept through that alarm unless the clock just wasn't working. So we decided that the clock wasn't working. But the landlady woke us up. I call her the landlady, but she ran the hotel. She did everything in the hotel except cook the dinners. And I don't know, she might have even cooked the dinners. She waited on all the tables. She did all the bookkeeping. She took us up to our rooms and carried all our bags up to our rooms. She was the only person we saw in this hotel that did any work. She was the only person in the hotel. And she did all the work. And she was just this, she was sort of slight and very quiet-faced and spoke very quietly and just sort of, I don't know, sort of a mousy looking little woman with a little bun of hair right here, and very, very nice. She was so nice and she looked after us so well, but she did all the work, all of it. When she was a waitress, she'd put on an apron and be the waitress, and then when she, after dinner, if somebody was going to pay their bill, she'd walk into the lobby, she'd take off her apron and put it down, and she'd go into the office and she'd be the manager. And then she'd come back out and she'd put on her apron again and she'd wait on tables again.
Did you put that down?
No.
What happened?
I didn't.
You just go right in there.
With that, it just happened.
I don't see how you all could better tear yourself away from that little place. The interesting places, you see, they just leave them there.
She was so disturbed when I told her. her that we were going to walk to the beach. That poor woman, she'd never heard of anybody trying to walk down the mountain to go to the beach. And I went and asked her the first morning we were there. I said, now we've heard that there's a beach here and we want to go to the beach. We came to go to the beach and it had been raining for 2 days and it was still raining. There was just rain pouring down and we said we were going to go to the beach. And I said, where is the beach? And she said, the road is right behind the hotel. And I said, oh, that's nice. How far is it? And she said, it's 4 kilometers. Straight down. She said, you have a car, don't you? And I said, no, we're going to walk. And she looked at me as if I had completely lost my mind. Nobody walked like that in Corsica. I mean, you could walk somewhere, but you didn't walk straight down the mountain. And we didn't either after one time down. We stuck our thumb out after that.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. We hitchhiked up back and forth. Up
4 kilometers, even down the mountain, was a good ways.
4 kilometers is a long distance. I don't know how many miles it is, but it's a long distance when you're going down a mountain or up a mountain. The incline was about 45 degrees. I mean, well, 45 degrees, like that. And it wasn't so far if we could have just sort of slid down the mountain, but the road made hairpin turns just like that, so you were just walking and walking forever. And it was so mean because you'd get around a turn and you'd think, oh, we've walked so far, and then you'd realize that you hadn't gone anywhere at all. You were just doubled back on the road where you were before. You hadn't made any progress at all. It was frustrating more than anything else, and going back up was just awful.
But you ate that little?
In the hotel, that's the only place we ate. Because we paid for breakfast and dinner there. And Russell made budgets all the time.
Oh, no.
She made so many budgets. She was very worried that her money wasn't going to last. And so every couple of days she'd sit down, she'd open her book, and she'd say, all right, we're going to plan our francs. And we'd plan, she'd write it down. She'd write down that we could spend so many francs for dinner and we could spend so many francs for wine. She never forgot the wine. And we could spend so many francs for this and so many francs for that. And she'd get it all planned out. And if anything happened to upset how many francs she could spend on something, she was just discombobulated for a day. She didn't know what to do if she had sidestepped her budget. Well, part of her budget was that we didn't buy any lunch in Corsica. She said, we're paying $5 to stay in this hotel, and that's enough. We're not buying lunch. So we'd eat breakfast, and then we'd go to the beach all day, and then we'd come back and we'd eat dinner. And actually, they gave us so much food to eat for dinner, we couldn't possibly have eaten lunch anyway. We'd never have been able to eat dinner because they gave us about 6 courses of food. A whole fish and a whole steak and just on and on and on and on. You had to starve yourself all day to be able to eat it. So, and part of the budget was that we had to have a bottle of wine with every meal. So that had to, you know, it takes a lot to consume a bottle of wine too. A whole bottle, a fifth. Not a split, a whole one. Of course, then after we ate, all we had to do was just sort of toddle up the stairs, which was a good thing. Because we'd never have made it if we'd had to go out on the town in Piana. The only public buildings in that town were a church and a cafe, and oh, there was some kind of post office that had all its windows boarded up, and in front of it, it had this dying Greek warrior with this dying Greek nymph hanging over him. And Russell took all these pictures of that statue because she couldn't figure out why there was this dying Greek warrior in the middle of this little town of Piana. It was the funniest statue. It was fake marble, I guess. It was white and had sort of fake ivy growing on it. It had moss and things. And it was a dead warrior stretched out. And this little nymph leaning over him, and we tried and tried. There was no inscription, and it was just in front of the post office. We tried and tried to figure out who this warrior could be that had fallen carrying the mail or something. I don't know. That was all there was to Piana, that and a lot of plane trees and eucalyptus trees and houses.
Eucalyptus, clear on down there.
Beautiful eucalyptus trees. They're so pretty. The bark comes off and curls all down. And they smell so good. They get little fruits, little berries that fall off and smell just wonderful. You pick them up and crush them. So good.
Well, you ate at the hotel for several days.
3 or 4.
Yeah. Oh, gee whiz.
A lot of food.
There's a lot of food.
Mm-hmm. We had fresh fish every night. They'd catch the fish down in the ocean, at the sea. And we usually have something to start out with, like I've forgotten now what we'd have for our first course. We'd have some kind of pasta, and then they'd bring in the fish after that, and a vegetable with the fish. And then they'd bring in, the third course was always, without fail, was always, oh, we must have started out with soup. We must have started out with soup. And then we'd have fish and a vegetable. And then the third course was always a steak about this big and French fried potatoes. And then they would bring in the cheese, and they'd give us these goat cheeses about this big. You didn't eat the whole cheese. You just cut off part of it. And then we'd have fruit and dessert. Or sometimes the fruit would be a dessert. And then we'd have coffee after that. Plus we'd have a bottle of wine along with it.
Mm.
A whole bottle of wine. So you see, we really didn't, Russell was right, we really didn't need to eat lunch at all.
I'd never leave that place.
we used to have just the most fantastic breakfast too. Just fantastic. They had fat loaves of bread, not the skinny kind, but fat ones. And so the pieces of bread would be about, well, they'd be thin this way, but wide. The loaves were wide. And then butter. And some kind of wild berry jelly. We could never figure out what it was, but we thought it was must have been some kind of wild plums or wild grapes or something like that from around the village. And coffee. And they used to give us cream that was so rich. It was like melted butter that you put in your coffee. It was yellow. It was so rich. Are you licking your lips?
Yes, I'm just taking it all in.
It was delicious. It was good. So you see, we
had breakfast.
At breakfast, had all that.
Goodness.
Had all that.
At Corsica.
Uh huh.
You didn't expect all that.
At Corsica. I didn't expect anything too much from Corsica. I thought it would have pretty scenery. Well, I saw all the scenery. Russell slept through all the scenery. But I saw all that, and the scenery was pretty. But that was really all I expected from it. I didn't even expect the beach to be too much. And it wasn't. It was a pretty sorry excuse for a beach. It was pretty small.
Now, you were talking about, and you said Russell was pretty well organized. Didn't you?
Yes.
But she always missed that bus. And those connections she made was just lapses in her well organization.
Yeah, she.
You slept through the alarm.
Yes.
And the only thing that saved you was the landlady. She's a hotel lady.
She came up and knocked on the door and told us that not only had we slept through our alarm, but the bus was not coming when we thought it was coming. And she had come to wake us up earlier because we told her the night before that I'd explained, she knew our life history practically because I explained everything that we were doing to her. And she knew that we had to take this bus. And she also knew that we thought it was coming at 7:30. And it wasn't. It was for some unknown reason. She knew it was coming earlier, and she didn't tell us the night before. She just found out in the morning by somehow. And she never said how she found out that it was going to be early. But she just came up early with our breakfast and knocked on the door to wake us up. And she rap, rap, rap on the door. And I heard her knocking, and I thought, oh, my God, we've slept through the alarm. And I thought, well, it's all right because we still have half an hour till the bus comes and we can make it. But then I opened the door to take the tray from her, and she said, well, the bus is going to be early. You better hurry. And I thought, oh, no, it's happened, because we had counted on an hour to pack everything. I mean, it would take Russell an hour to find everything in the room. So Russell didn't say anything. We didn't talk at all. Russell just sort of, we lifted up out of the bed, and we just started tearing around the room. And we had things sort of hanging around. We'd hung our bathing suits out the window and things like that. And we just sort of, I have this impression of taking a big hand and going like that around the room and getting everything. And somehow it ended up in the right suitcases. And somehow I was finished a long time before Russell was, because I sat down and I poured the coffee and I had a cup of coffee, and Russell was doing something. I don't know what she was doing. It took her so much longer, and I said, you better drink your coffee. And she said, well, I'll get to it. And I said, how about if I butter the bread and put it in the paper napkin, and we can take it on the bus and eat it on the bus, and then we won't take time to eat it here. And she said that sounded like a good idea. So I made sandwiches, bread and butter and jelly sandwiches, and wrapped them up and put them in my suitcase, and I was ready to go. And so I left, and I don't know what she was doing. I don't know why it took her so long. Just washing her face or something, I don't know. And so I got down, and there was the bus, was there. And I thought, oh, it's happened, we're going to miss this bus. I will have to contend with a nervous breakdown, probably, Russell, when something drastic will happen. And I kept thinking what I could do to keep the bus from going. And I figured out that if I didn't get on the bus, the bus driver couldn't leave because he'd see me there, and he couldn't drive away and leave a passenger standing in the road. And if I didn't get on until Russell came, then he couldn't leave until I got on until Russell came. So it was all very neat. It worked. And so I just was sort of standing around looking at the bus, looking up at the luggage rack, seeing if my suitcase would go up there, talking to him about my suitcase. And Russell appeared after a while. She came out, and I said, Russell, the bus is here. And so she ran up and got on the bus, and we climbed onto the bus and got our suitcases on, and Russell sat down, and I sat down, and then I said, do you want to have your breakfast now? And Russell said, buses make me sick, and she took a bus sickness pill, and she fell asleep in 5 minutes and slept for 3 hours into a taxi. And I woke her up when we got to the bus station. And I said, we're back! You can wake up now, you missed all the scenery.
She was pretty well organized.
She tried to be.
Yeah.
She liked lists. She kept more lists of all the things that she could say. You know, like the first day that we were in Paris, she decided she would start making a list of all the obscene things that were said to us, and she was so disappointed because nothing was said. So every time we'd go past somebody and they'd say something in French, she'd say, what did they say? She'd been hearing all this about Paris for as long as she could.
Oh. But I never thought about her making a list.
But you don't have that down. You don't have either one of them down.
I have down a little bit about the bus in Corsica.
What do you mean a little bit?
A little bit. Just working on it a little bit. I didn't put down about the woman who ran the hotel changing her apron. I liked about that. before all it wrestles with.
I declare. That you can have Corsica. I'll just take that woman and run to that hotel and change those aprons.
That's right.
And she's the only one you saw around there that did anything.
She's the only one we saw. In the whole hotel, she was the only person who worked in the hotel. Everybody else that we saw was staying in the hotel, except for this woman. She was the only one who worked there, and that we saw. There must have been people in the kitchen, because I refuse to believe that she was able to cook everything and then bring it out by herself and serve it too. There must have been a cook in the kitchen. But she also, in the mornings, early in the morning, you could look out the window and she'd be buying all the food. The farmers would come in with their donkeys and their carts, and she'd be out buying all the food. She'd buy all the potatoes and everything every day when they came by. So she did everything. She was the business manager, she was the waitress, she carried our bags up the stairs. She did, little woman. I never saw her sweep up, but she probably did that at night when we weren't looking.
Yeah, because it
everything.
Was swept.
It was swept. It was very clean. They'd have to sweep it because they didn't have rugs on the floor. It was just the bare floors.
Well, there's something to be said for that. You never wear out a floor anyhow. But there were others eating there.
Oh yes, there were a lot of people staying there. She had a lot of work to do at night to get around to all the tables. We'd all come down. We were supposed to eat at 7:30, I think. And we'd all start coming down about 7:15 because everyone would be home. I don't know, maybe everybody didn't eat lunch in preparation for dinner. I don't know, but Russell and I were usually so hungry by 7 that we'd sit around, we'd get all ready, and we'd be ready at 7:00, and we'd sit on, each of us would sit on our bed, and we'd just sort of sit there like this. And then at about 7:15, we'd decide, well, we could go down and we could sit in the lobby, and then we'd smell dinner anyway, and that would be almost as good as eating. And so we'd go down and we'd sit in the lobby, and people would sort of start filtering in all the other people that were staying there. There weren't a lot. It wasn't a big hotel. There would be maybe 4 or 5 tables full of people.
Well, gee whiz, that's a whole lot.
Well, it's 10-12 people.
Sure.
That's pretty many. For not being a very big hotel, it's pretty many. And we'd all be down there about 7:30. But then probably because that poor woman was also helping cook the meal, we never got started eating till about 8, and so we'd all sit, and by the time we finally ate, everybody would be there waiting, and then we'd run out of chairs, and people would stand, and everyone would sort of work their hands a little bit like this, waiting, because there weren't anything to do, there weren't any magazines or anything like that.
And you ate for an hour?
Oh, longer than that. That was the evening's entertainment. That and watching everybody else. We'd trade seats because we had the place by the window, the table by the window. So one of us looked out the window and the other one looked into the room. And we kept trading every night so that we could tell the other one about what everyone else was doing. And we'd make up stories about everybody else. That's a good game in a hotel, to make up stories about the people that are there. We used to do that in Nice all the time.
Oh, really?
At the Della Robbia. There was one couple that we called the headholders because they sat right behind us. You always sit at the same table. And we always sat.
Just through habit.
Well, and if you're living in the hotel.
Oh, your napkin's there.
No, well, at the Della Robbia, our napkins weren't there. At the place in Corsica, our napkins were there. So we had to sit where our napkins were. The Della Robbia, they gave you clean napkins all the time. But we always sat at the same table, but we always rotated. So I made Russell do it too. We always rotated so that different people could look out and keep an eye on everybody. And then the best one was Mr. and Mrs. Headholder. And they sat right behind us. And Mrs. Headholder used to just talk a monologue all the time. She just talked and talked and talked. And Mr. Headholder sat like this. And he read with one hand like this, and every once in a while he'd put the book down and he'd eat, and then he'd pick it up and he'd read some more. And Mrs. Headholder just talked incessantly. She just talked, and just a steady, constant stream like this. She just talked along like this, and she talked. Her voice was low enough so that we could never hear what she was saying. We were trying to figure out what language she was speaking, at least. But we could never figure it out because her voice was just low enough so that it didn't carry. We could just see that her mouth was moving all the time. She just didn't stop talking the whole time. And he never said a word in 2 weeks. He just sat and held his head and read paperback books. I think they were Agatha Christie's. I'm not sure, but I think they were. Because there was quite a collection of Agatha Christie's in the lobby, and I think he picked one up every night as he came through, and he probably read the whole book at dinner. Listening to her talk, and we never even ascertained whether or not they were husband and wife, but we assumed they were.
Agatha Christie's tempting, you know. Once you get started, it's hard to say, lay down in it. You weren't on course, good. How long were you?
Almost a week. We went on a Tuesday and we left on Sunday.
And you went to the beach every day?
No. First day we got there. Let's see. We got there from Nice on Tuesday in the evening. And then the next day we went to Piana, but it took us most of the day to get there. So
you had written ahead for a reservation.
Yes, at the nunnery. I'd written to the nunnery because a friend of mine in Nice had said, if you wanted a cheap place to stay, stay in a Catholic school. So she was living in a Catholic school in Nice in the dorm. And she'd gone back and asked the Mother Superior if there was a place in Ajaccio where we could stay, and the Mother Superior said yes, and gave her the address and said, when you write, say that you were writing after my, I don't know how to translate it, after the wishes of Sister so-and-so in need. So I did, and poor Sister Bernadette was so distressed when she got my letter that she called this other sister in Nice and asked her about who I was, because I had written and said that we'd like two rooms with a bed in each room, because Vesna said to me, in a nunnery, there are just these narrow little rooms, and there's one narrow cot in each room, and so you better ask her for two rooms, because there are two of you, and you don't want to have just one cot for two people. And I said, no, that's right, we don't. So that's why I'd asked for two rooms. Well, she was very upset because the only room that they had to give us was one room with two beds, and she thought maybe we wouldn't be able to sleep in the same room together. And so she called Nice and she said, I have two beds, but I only have one room. What am I supposed to do? And the nun in Nice thought this was terribly funny. And so she told her, well, you better watch out, because these girls are rich Americans, and you better watch out when they get there, because they're rich and they're used to having it good. You know how Americans are. Well, the nun in Ajaccio was so distressed. She was just so distressed because all she had was one room and two beds. So she wrote me this letter I have somewhere, and she said, I can keep you, but I only have one room and two beds. You can stay there. It's where the girls stayed who came to us at the Pentecost. And I thought, who were the girls that came at the Pentecost? Did they speak in many tongues? I wasn't sure. And but you can have it. You can have this room. It will be very happy to receive you. And then she told me that they changed the name of the school and that the sign might be changed. And so I'd better be careful when I came, because it might not be St. Marie anymore. It might be St. Paul. And I was to get the right school. So we arrived, and everything was absolutely fine. It was the infirmary. We stayed in the infirmary. And I just remembered this afternoon that she didn't have any sheets or anything on the bed, which is fine. There was a blanket. But the beds, since it was in the infirmary, the beds had rubber all the way around them. You know, those rubber mattress cases that you put on mattresses in hospitals. And so you sit on the bed, and it would rattle. All this rubber and plastic would rattle. And there was nothing we could do about it. Anytime you moved your toe, the whole bed would rattle. And then you'd sort of stick, you know, how do you stick the plastic?
Russell was with you.
Yes. But there were two beds in one room, and it was fine. It really was fine.
No sheep.
But you
no
didn't
sheep.
See much of her, the sister there.
The sister. She met us. She wasn't the sister superior. That's wrong. She was the. Whoops. She was the. What do they call it? The woman, the treasurer. Because we were supposed to pay for staying in the room, and so I think that's why they forwarded the letter to her. The Mother Superior probably said, here's a chance for us to make some money. I doubt it, because they ended up asking us for $1 to stay in the room, and we were sort of embarrassed. We thought that wasn't quite enough, but anyway, she met us, and we had thought that they might lock us up in the nunnery, and we'd been a little worried about it. Russell, I think, hadn't worried about that very much.
Locking Russell up in a nunnery.
Russell wasn't really worried that we were going to be locked up in the nunnery. I think she thought it was kind of a kick that we were going to stay in a nunnery, because she religion is one of the institutions that she wants to overthrow. And she thought if she could get in there, she could probably overthrow it. And I think that she was sort of intrigued by the idea of staying in this nunnery. No, but none of her friends in New York had ever spent the night in a nunnery. But I was worried that they were going to get us in there and lock us up, and there we'd be, just locked up in the nunnery. I thought maybe they had hours or something, that we had to leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and be back by 6 or something, and I didn't particularly want to do that. So I was a little bit nervous about whether or not they were going to let us come and go, or whether we'd have to pay for the chains when we paid for the room. And the first thing she did was she gave us a key, and she said, I know you want to come and go. You know, you want to be able to leave. And we said, yes, that was very nice. And I said, phew, silently. And Russell just thought, aha, it's time. My time has come. Here's this nunnery I'm going to overthrow. And she took us, it was old buildings. And the place that we slept, the infirmary, was divided somehow from the school. We had gone into the front door of the school and had gone through all these corridors and gotten up into the treasurer's office. And then she met us there and took us back down all these corridors and down some stairways and up some other stairways and across the top of the building and down the other side and up a couple more flights of stairs and down again and up. And eventually we got into the dormitory where the nuns stayed. And except that there were a few classrooms there too, because in the morning we'd go by these closed doors and we could hear, and then it'd be quiet, and then the children were in the rooms. And so I'm not really sure how they had everything arranged, but anyway, the infirmary was there, and a couple of nuns also slept on that floor with us. And she gave us the key to the room and the key to that building. We didn't have the run of the school. She probably thought we'd have gotten lost in it. So it was so big. And she just showed us how to work the locks, because there was something funny about the lock on the back door, and she showed us how to work the locks. And then she left us alone, she asked us what we wanted to have for breakfast. I think she was obsessed with the idea that we were rich Americans. I think she wanted to be sure she had the right thing for us for breakfast. She wanted to know if we drank tea, because she would get tea for us. She was really nice, and to have all the right things for us. We said, oh, anything was fine, and what time should we come? And she told us that they ate from, I don't know, 6:30 to 7:30 or something like that, but if we wanted to come after 7:30, it was all right. So we did. No, I think we must have gone shortly after 7:30, because there were still people having breakfast when we went. She showed us where the kitchen was, and we were supposed to go down the stairs and go to the window, and the shutters just opened out. There were no glass or anything like that, and lean our head in the window into the kitchen and yell, and someone would come and give us our breakfast.
Well, gee whiz, it looked to me like you were at home just as soon as you got there.
Oh, we were.
Goodness. Goodness. Just imagine. Just imagine. And you got the keys to the house.
The keys to the house. And she liked us so much. She, I don't know what she was expecting from us. I mean, she must have really, I would love to know what kind of fantasy she had about us before we came. She must have really wondered about us, but she was so nice. We went and told her that we were going to go down to Piana for 3 or 4 days and that we wanted to come back and spend the night again. And then we were going to pay her for the night that we'd been there. And she said, oh, don't pay me now. Wait till you come back and pay me then. And then when we finally paid her, she gave us postcards of Ajaccio, just pictures of the buildings and the streets, you know, ugly, ugly postcards, but she gave them to us because we were tourists, and she wanted us to remember her city, and it was really nice. I thought it was such a...
Well, now, did you do the talking, or did she? She did.
She did. She talked because she was showing us how to use everything.
Yes, and telling you about the city.
A little. Well, Ajaccio is not very big. She just told us. She told us that. Well, they were on the main street, the biggest street. The school was, and she just told us. That we could. She told us we could find places to eat up and down the street, and I can't remember whether she told us where the bus station was or not. No, she didn't. We found out where the bus station was from. We started walking. We thought we'd find out where the bus went to Piana, and we got in front of the police station, the town hall, and there was a policeman outside. And so I said, well, why don't we ask the policeman where the bus station is, because he'll know. He should know. So I asked him, and he didn't know, but he was talking to somebody who did, and so this man grabbed us by the hand.
Gosh, that's so loud.
Grabbed us by the hand and walked us down to the bus station, and he was so concerned that we'd be sure and know right where the bus station was and everything that he took us there,
took
hand
it.
In hand.
Well, I'm glad that you finally got home. Well, we dropped back.
That sound more like you and Doug Russell. Is she not interested in those little things? She's not interested in the in the lady's sister treasurer and the locks and going down and calling her breakfast out through the door, through the window. Huh?
I don't think she was as much interested in that, no. But she really liked the idea of staying in a nunnery, though. She just thought that was wonderful. When I told her that, she got off the plane, and as I met her at the airport, and we were driving back to the UNALS, and I said, Russell, we're going to stay in a nunnery in Corsica. And she was so excited. She was just so pleased that we were going to do something as different as stay in a nunnery, because she just...
Really?
Nobody had ever done that she knew, stayed overnight in a nunnery.
Yeah.
She was.
But now she couldn't, that little place like that, she couldn't possibly want to undermine it.
I think it's just the idea of religion that she wants to undermine.
Yeah.
She didn't really want to undermine the sister. She liked her too.
Well, that's it. You know, when I think of those little establishments like that, I don't know. There's what goes on in them. I don't know what goes on in them, you know. But just from the outside, you'd think that's the way everything ought to be. There ought to be a whole lot of things like that. course you can't have them here, not in this country, could you? I don't think so.
I don't know.
You wouldn't have anyone to give you the key to the door, show you how to unlock the door. It wouldn't bother with you that much. It'd be like a motel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Debbie, I don't want to go ahead of your calendar though now, but. What did you have in mind when you said you and Russell just ate your way across France? That was up north in France?
Well, no, it really, it started in Corsica, in that little hotel.
Yes.
Eating so much there, and then we got to Arles, and Russell found this restaurant in Arles. She found it. I don't know how she found it. She looked in a guidebook or something, and she found this restaurant. And see, it was cheap. That was the whole thing. It was cheap. And Russell, it fit the budget. And Russell decided that we should eat dinner there every night that we were in Arles, because wasn't it a good meal for 10 francs? And I said, well, yeah, it was a good meal. So we ate dinner there every night. Well, the menu was not that expansive in this little place. It was really small. The whole restaurant was about the size of this kitchen, and there were about six tables. Well, the restaurant and the kitchen, where they cooked, was about the size of this kitchen, because they had two tables against one wall, and then the door to the kitchen, and then against the other wall there were three tables, and that was it. And a man and his wife and his daughter ran it. The daughter waited the tables. The man sat you down and gave you your menu, and his wife did all the cooking out in the kitchen. And they had, there were about three things that you could have on the menu, so we rotated around, we had one each night. And then they gave you the same vegetable every night, and the same hors d'oeuvres every night. Well, that was all right, you know, I mean, it was all right. But three nights in a row, you know, it gets a little tiring to be eating the same thing. But we did, because Russell found this restaurant and it fit the budget. So we ate there every night. And that was when she started, at that restaurant, she started writing down, making lists of things that we ate. And I thought, this is so cockeyed, because this was the worst restaurant we ate in France. And that's when she started writing down these lists about how good the food was. And I thought, oh. But I didn't say anything. I let her make a list. And I went and ate there every night with her. I went. Didn't say a thing. Another reason that she liked it was that the wine was free with the meal. So she could take that off the budget, and we could spend the wine money for something else. It was just incredible how she had her francs worked out. She really did. She'd work it out so that we could only have one coffee, or if it was a bad day, we'd have a glass of wine, because wine was a lot cheaper than coffee in the middle of the day. This is because she was afraid she'd run out of money before she got to Paris. And don't you know, Paris is expensive, she kept telling me. We're going to run out of money before we get to Paris. We better hurry up and get to D's, because we won't have to pay any money at D's.
You had friends there.
Oh, yeah, we had friends. See that? Russell said, we better hurry up and get to D's, because we got to stop paying hotel bills. It didn't fit the budget. I was so enchanted with her budget. Let her sit down and budget my money, too. Oh, baby. I mean, she was just amazing with her money. I had a friend in college who used to say that Russell was tighter than any wallpaper she'd ever seen. And I guess it's true. Oh.
she made her money go a long way.
Oh, she certainly did.
Even
she
back in school. Did.
Even in school, she made her money go a long way. She just never spent it. I mean, somebody else spent it.
Well, who bought all that beer?
Oh, she did. She spent money on beer and cigarettes.
Yeah.
That was she spent money on that, but she didn't spend money on anything else.
Yeah.
First things first.
Well, you know, that's kind of like, you know, when I saw horses, good horses go for $5,500, and the same person, you see, would buy a car and pay $1,000, $2,000, you see, and the poor horse, he started counting his pennies, you see. That bothered me. It doesn't now, it's an old story now. Calf is still worth more than a horse. And no trouble to raise a calf, you see. I don't understand that sort of an economy. And a horse, you know, is the one that's friendly with you. These calves out here come out and they beat me down all the time, you see. But after I get out there, all they want is a handout. And if I go up to speak to them, they are skittish. They're touchers. This is the most touchers bunch of animals I ever had, Faye.
Well, hallelujah.
To be as big beggars as they are. I don't understand that. That bucket, you know, is irresistible. But you can't touch them. But two of them, they'll all scamper.
And a horse will run all the way across the pasture for one
carrot. For one carrot. Isn't that something? One carrot.
Well, Debbie, you say you were interested in the food, and you sat there and ate everything they brought, but there was a whole lot else going on, too, there in Corsica, in that little restaurant hotel. Now, the one in Aro, was that anything going on there?
Well, the three people that ran it did the same thing. The little girl served the tables, and the man that ran it wanted you to think that he was doing all the work. Now, he was the one that looked busy all the time. But anybody could look into the kitchen and see who was doing all the cooking was his wife, and the one that carried all the plates to the table was his daughter. And all he really did was make sure that he got you in the door. The door had fly, sort of plastic fly screen in it. You had to go in like that, like going into the Casbah in Morocco, only it was plastic, faded plastic, yellow and green and red, all faded, and get your way in. And this man would be waiting for you as if your long lost friend. Well, we went three nights in a row, and it was more than he could bear. I probably never had three customers come back in his entire career. And we came back every night at 7 o'clock to eat that 10-franc meal. And he'd, well, where would you like to sit tonight, he'd say. And there are five tables to choose from. And, well, we'd sit at a different table every night. And he thought this was wonderful, I suppose. We weren't creatures of habit. We didn't go back to the table in the corner. We'd sit at different tables. And then he'd bring us the menu that we'd seen every night. We'd read the menu, which was this long. We'd read already. We knew. Russell would say to me as we walked in, well, tonight I think I'll have such and such. And he'd come and, what will you have tonight, he'd say. As if he didn't know we'd read his menu every night. Knew his menu by heart. And then he'd come back and he'd take our order, and then he'd walk the three steps over to the kitchen to get, he was trying to be very, you know, this was a very high class establishment. He wasn't going to yell the order across the room into his wife in the kitchen, so he'd walk across and he'd give the order. But as soon as he walked into the kitchen, then he'd raise his voice, and the room was only this big, and you could hear everything he said in the kitchen. It was just that he didn't yell from one room to the other, he yelled in the kitchen. And then he would, that was all he'd do. His daughter would do the serving after that. She never said a word, and his wife never said a word. He's the only one that ever said anything. He'd go in and...
And he was limited just to a few. You didn't talk to him.
No. We didn't. Because he was too busy walking in the kitchen to give the order.
Well, what were you doing at all?
Russell wanted to see the Roman ruins. Oh. So we went to see the Roman ruins. And we ended up not looking at them very long. We went to see... This is the whole reason we went to Arles, to see these damn ruins.
That's what I thought.
We walked into the Colosseum and we climbed up to the top. And they had these, the arches, the tops of the arches with nothing on it. And I said, oh, Russell, let's go up and walk on the arches. And so we did, and it turns out she's got, what's it called with your afraid of heights? She's got vertigo. She doesn't like heights. And we got up there, and I was walking along, and Russell was stopped about three arches behind me, and she said, I think I want to go down now. Oh. Oh. And that was so much for the Colosseum. You couldn't get down into the bottom of it. The only place to see it was from the top of the arches. So we left the Colosseum then, and we went to the monastery instead, which was actually very nice. But the whole reason for going was the Colosseum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided to ride horses in the Camarog, too. So we stayed a day to do that.
Oh, that was the same place.
Yes, yes. I don't know how we decided to ride horses in the Camarog. I
never heard of a Camarog.
Well, it's the Florida and Texas of France. It's the bus driver told us that. I started talking to the bus driver because we got on the, it took us an hour to get down from Arles into the Camarog. It's a big swamp where the Rhone River empties into the sea. And we wanted to go ride horses, so we found out that we could take a bus to St. Mary by the sea, and that there would be some horses there. And so I said to Russell as we got on the bus, well, you know, there'll probably be one place where we can rent horses, and with our luck we won't find it. And she said, oh, we'll find it. I'm sure there's more than one place where we can rent horses. But then about halfway on the trip, she said, I think you better go talk to the bus driver and find out where the ranch is, find out where these horses are. And so I went up and I started talking to the bus driver. And he started telling me a little bit about the Camarog. And he said that it's flat. It looks a little bit like Florida in that it's flat and it has sort of swampy vegetation. So they call it the Florida of France. But it also has wild horses that they go out and round up and put in ranches. And so they also call it the Texas of France because this is where you go to be a cowboy. And he said that, he told me that they always tell the Parisians, because the Parisians come down to the Camarog to go riding, and they get off the bus and they go into the first store and buy a 10-gallon hat, which comes from Texas. And then they go prancing around on these wild horses, and they think that they're cowboys. And he said, nobody in St. Mary's likes the Parisians, and you can always tell a Parisian by his Texas 10-gallon hat. He didn't call it a 10-gallon hat, but that's what it was, those big hats. And so I went back, and he told me that there were plenty of places to rent horses. And so I went back and I told Russell that there were plenty of places to rent horses. We didn't have to worry. Our problems were over. And as we got a little farther down the road, we passed one of these ranches. And the ranch being a hitching post with about six horses tied up to it, a little shed, a little peaked shed over the top, peaked roof. And one sort of lonesome gypsy cowboy who leans against the post and waits for you to come and rent the horses. And so we saw this ranch, and there was a big sign that said horses have a horse ride in the swamps and rent your horse here, sort of thing, big sign. And so Russell and I looked at each other and we thought, there's our ranch, we better get off the bus. Well, the bus was by it before we had decided that we should get off. And so Russell said, I think we better go sit in the front of the bus, because otherwise we're going to pass all these ranches before we get to town. So we moved up to the front seat in the bus and started talking to the bus driver again. And he said, well, what I'll do for you is you stay on the bus until we get into town. Then I'll take you back out and I'll leave you at whatever ranch you want to go to. Just ride all the way in and look at all of them. And you pick the one you want to stop at. And then as we're coming back to Arles, I'll let you off. So he said, well, that was really nice of him. And so we went all the way into town to the beach and let everybody off. And then we started back out again. And we picked the first one outside of town to stop
now,
at.
Now, what did you look like when the bus driver was going to be that nice to you? You have on old jeans?
Yes. I had on jeans and tennis shoes and an old shirt. But we were foreign.
What did Russell have on?
Same thing.
Goodness.
But we were foreign, and that makes a lot of difference. We didn't.
You found it there?
Well, he knew that I wasn't French, and Russell wasn't speaking a word of French, so he knew we were foreign.
You think that made a difference?
Yes, I think that's the reason. He thought he was being nice to strangers, I guess.
So, he picked out that place where the stallion was.
We picked out the place where the stallion was. We just got off, the bus because, I think it was because we didn't want to be so far from town for catching the bus going back. So we just got off the bus as soon as we were outside of town. And there were about six of these little ranch places up and down each side of the road. And Russell said to me, well, not only do we not have to worry about finding a ranch, but we can comparison shop for the cheapest ride with what would fit in the budget. So I said, all right, you take that one across the street and I'll take this one. And she said, no, well, let's just go to this one. So we went up and we asked the man who was running this one if we could rent horses for the day, and he said no. We could rent them for 2 hours in the morning, and that was the longest, and 2 hours again in the afternoon, and we said, okay, that was fine, we'd do that. So we got two horses, and we got up and got on, and there was a girl who was staying in one of the hotels, and then a man and his wife sort of came driving up and got on just as we were leaving, and the guardian took us out. And we rode for 2 hours, but Russell and I had very, very slow horses. He asked us, had you ever ridden before? And I said, yes. And I must have not looked like I had or something. Because he gave us very slow horses, and Russell was just incensed at this. She was very upset that we didn't have fast horses. She wanted to go fast because we were riding on the beach, just on the flat beach, and she just wanted to go fast. She kept, my horse was slower than hers, and she kept coming back to me at the end of the line saying, you tell him we need fast horses. Veet, veet, veet. She zipped by him and she said, I need a veet, veet horse.
Oh, damn.
And so I was set with telling this man that we wanted faster horses, so I tried to be nice about it. You know, I didn't want to. I said we'd like to have horses that went a little faster in the afternoon, and he said, well, all right. He could see that we could ride. Russell, meanwhile, was convinced that we were America's gift to the cowboys of the Camarade because we could ride better than anyone in our little group, which was not saying too much because they'd never been on a horse before. This girl had only ridden about three times, and of course she couldn't ride. But our cowboy said that, yes, he would give us faster horses in the afternoon and to come back at 2 o'clock. So we went off and had lunch somewhere, walked on the beach for a while, and then at 1:30 we went back, and we were just sort of sitting looking at the horses. They were all tied up there. And we noticed that there was a stallion. And it wasn't a very big stallion, but it was a stallion. And I just sort of mentioned to Russell that gee, I'd never ridden a stallion. Had she ever ridden a stallion? And she said, no, she never had. The only kind of cow ponies they ever had in Mississippi were either geldings or mares. And her mother wouldn't have a stallion on the place. Well, first horse that man saddled was the stallion. And the first horse he let out was the stallion. And there we were sitting there. And I said, Russell, I think we're going to have to ride it. Danny, you pointed to me. And he said, to me. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm going to die right here on the camera. It's just unfair. It was not even my fault. I wasn't the one that wanted the horse to go beat beat. And I'm the one that's going to die riding this stallion. So I went and got on him. Russell looked a little pale. Well, she might have. And it's her fault. And so I got on, and he said, now, he was enjoying it so much. Just
the cowboy.
The cowboy was loving it, just loving it. I got on, and I must have sort of said, when he said, come here, I probably said, me? Me? And I got on, and he said, all right, just don't let him go too fast. Well, that's the first thing you do to scare somebody, right? When they get on a horse, is to tell them, don't let him go too fast. It's the first thing. And then he said, don't hold the reins too tight. And he pulled on this horse's reins, and the horse went jumping around, you know, and I thought, oh, it's all over for me. So he gave Russell another horse, and there were a couple of other people, and he sent us off. He didn't go with us in the afternoon. That was his rest time. He only went in the morning, and he sent us off with somebody else for the afternoon. And we rode, and it was fine. The stallion and I got along just beautifully. We didn't have a bad time at all, and I think that the guardian was just distressed when I came back without something broken. He was just convinced that he'd really done it to me by giving me this horse. He thought that I would at least fall off and break something or snap the girth or something, you know. And I came back, and I was feeling really proud of myself. You know, I managed this horse so well. He hadn't gone too fast or anything. And so I came back in, and he said, you didn't have any trouble? And I said, no, none at all. He's such a nice horse.
Damn it.
What happened to Russell?
Well, Russell had a fine. Her horse went fast. Now, see, I didn't get to go fast in the afternoon because I was so scared that if I let this stallion go fast, I'd end up in America, he'd swim the ocean or something. So I had a very quiet afternoon. You know, I just sort of made him trot and walk and be very quiet. And Russell's tearing around on her horse. She had a marvelous time. She went fast.
But she'd been brought up riding fast.
Yes, that's the only kind of riding she'd ever done, is racing in the pastures on the cow ponies. She'd never done any other kind of riding.
Just get on and go.
Just get on and go, because they were work horses. They used them to round up the cattle. And the only person that ever had a good horse on their ranch was her mother. Her mother had a Tennessee walking horse. And Russell said she used to get on the kids would come home from college or something or on the weekends, and they'd get on the cow ponies, and her mother would get up on this big Tennessee walking horse, and they'd go for a ride. And she said her mother would sit up on the Tennessee walking horse and look down and say, certainly it's too bad you have to ride those plugs. So Russell said she never took up riding very much. But when we were coming, I just remembered when we were coming back across the Camrock, there were all these sort of watery places. I mean, where there was maybe 4 or 5 inches of water of the sand. And when we were coming back in the afternoon, the man said, do you want to ride across the water? Because we'd seen people riding across the water before. And Russell said, oh, sure, let's ride across the water. So we started out, and it was a long distance through the water, and about halfway across, this man turned around and he said to all of us in the line, now be sure your horses don't stop. You can't stop now. And then we were already in the middle. You know, I thought, no, the next thing he's going to tell us is that there's quicksand in the middle of this lake, and we're going to be, you know, mired not only on a stallion but mired up to his knees in quicksand. I don't think I enjoyed the afternoon as much as the morning.
I didn't know you all did new cemetery. Well, now, Russell was pretty good to travel with.
She is.
She's a good influence. Are you a spender?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I figured it was a good idea to let her budget my money too.
So that's a good influence on you too, you?
Well, sort of, yeah. Roundabout way. I don't spend too much. But I don't think about it too much either. I mean, I don't make budgets and plan my spending. I just sort of spend what I have in my pocketbook. If it's not there, I don't spend it. If it's there, I spend it. It's really very simple. It's much easier than making budgets.
Well, you haven't said a word to me that makes me want to eat anywhere you eat. And you're talking about eating your way around over there. Where did you do so much eating? At your nose. But not out in public.
No, not at the Unals, no, as long as we were eating there. One time they took us out to eat. They wanted me to eat soca, which is the...
No, I mean when you were out traveling, you really ate well?
Yes, we did, except in Arles. We didn't eat very well there. But we ate really well in Paris, because we'd discover all these streets full of restaurants. And we'd just go up and down the street picking out different restaurants. That was
in Paris.
Mm.
Was that for breakfast or lunch?
At night.
At night.
We didn't eat lunch. And now we ate our way across France, and we never ate but two meals a day. Now we used to sometimes in Paris we'd get bread and cheese or something at lunchtime. But most of the time, we didn't eat much for lunch. I didn't eat much at all.
And you didn't eat much for breakfast.
Well, where would you get bread and cheese? In a little bread and cheese store?
In a bread store and a grocery store.
Yeah.
But you had to get it before noon. They close up.
Yeah. And when you want to eat it, they arrest it.
Mm-hmm. They don't accommodate themselves.
I will tell you, Debbie, race will fly ahead of you, it's so simple.
After all that good talking.
He's ready to put things together. I don't know what we'll have time. He's going to help me on this grant business, because I don't get anywhere at all. And they do me just like they did you. Well, and but what are you going to do? You get that. That's the way they do me. And I don't look forward to it. It's irksome to me. See, I can tell them in 16 ways. But they still will say, but what are you going to do? They don't know what I've told them. See, on that little thing that I wrote out, I told them 1, 2, 3 ways and that, 3 or 4 ways and that. You see, I told them how it just happened into it with Miss Liza. And then the thing that actually gave me a goal where I could actually do something was the first statement that I made on what talk was. I was experienced, both of them experiences. And then I said it's kind of hard to look at exactly what I do, but I can tell it in terms of what this Robert Coates did. And I put out and pretty good, it helped me. I could see more clearly, kind of, you know, just, well, all it did was just itemize things. It's all there. I mean, and I put it down, what he did. But at the end, I still had to say that he, it was simpler for him to say what he was doing and also to put it in the book, because first and last, he was dealing with the underprivileged, and he was interested in social justice. And you see, those terms speak for themselves. But when you say that you are interested in listening to people talk and to hear the faculties that they have, and that you see, they say, well, what you gonna do? What are you interested in? And so yeah, I don't know what I can win. I don't think I can win. I think it's a lost cause. I can't imagine any foundation supporting me or this sort of proposition that I have to make to them. What do you do? What do you sit around the table after supper and just gab? What sort of tapes you make? You ask them questions? No. No questions. Why in the hell can you mount anything unless you ask a question and get a clear answer, you see? That'll kill you all. They don't need any more, you see. They may not just end up in the kind of interview at the right there on the spot, but you can see their interest visibly wane.
How many feet of tape do you have?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What kind of machines?
Wash Clark, you never knew him. You never knew anyone much around here, speaking, I can see. Wash always wore that Western shirt and his Western hat. And he had slowed down right smart when by the time I saw him, he'd had a heart attack. And I think he was dead for an hour or two, and they just brought him back to life. I mean, he had a bad one. So from then on, he was same old Wash Clark, but not without the vigor. But he was, at the time I did it, I thought, if this is not a great waste, I taught business English with Wash Clark. And just about everything he said would sort of sit wrong on me. Well, the way it wound up, I got so I'd just quote him all the time. Everything he said, I wondered, I'd missed that all along. That's the truth. He said, all of this, he says, is not much to learn in this business writing. He says, it's all a matter of attitude. Well, I thought, well, I'll be damned if I ever heard anything like that. But it's the truth. There's not anything to learn. It's just a matter of attitude. Well, Wash had a great way about him. He'd bait Dr. Wise. Oh, he'd bait him something awful in the office. And Dr. Wise would stand over there and give him time. Then he'd take over. He'd do that in faculty meetings. Wash would bait him. Not as much in detail. Wash had a lot of these curious little habits. He did it just for put on a show, you know, just to liven things up. And Jake went along with him. One of his tricks was, in class, he'd give the price right down to the nickel, except he'd make the whole thing up. But he'd go along with their instinct for accuracy. He wasn't accurate. He wasn't interested in that. Oh, there's a lot of nice things about a watch. He was, he belonged to the old world. He played poker all night. And, or just had all sorts of talk, all sorts of talk. And I couldn't appreciate. Oh, I was stiff. God almighty. When I got out here, I don't know how they stood me. They did have a hard time.
That's right. He did have that marvelous talk.
Yeah.
One of the few.
And he knew it. And the others knew those things too. Some of them. That's something they can't tell you. Oh, it takes so long to learn that. I worked with Weiss for several years. It's all a matter of attitude. And it's phenomenal how far that'll go. That's in letters of collection letters, and direct mail and all. Whole thing. This, you know, I even forget the types of them now, but they have a chapter on each one.
In Business English.
Business English. And that's where it works out. And, Rick, I'm going to get up in the morning and do my setting up exercise, see if I can't get my mind to working. And before I go up there, I'm gonna set down some objectives so I'll have them handy. I set down a number. I've set them down from time to time, then I don't keep them on my mind. I don't want to remember all that stuff.
Well, it's just too bad that whoever's involved couldn't hear Debbie report tonight.
Well, Rick reported on.
Sure, both of you. Yeah. You know, then
yeah.
I just don't know whether it's possible to say.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to hear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it just comes to life.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll never read Korska without seeing this woman, this little bitty woman.
Now, let me tell you, Rick, I got several things on now, and I'm going to work with you a little now, if it works out that way. That's my plan. And we're going to get some things down. And but I got to work on this grant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an incipient thing, I can't do anything else. If I went to Sunday school, that'd be all I could think about. I might not think about it. Or I might just be cussing. But I couldn't think about anything else, put it that way. Oh,
it's not the grant. It's
what they do to you.
Yeah. It's what you have to go through.
Make you learn.
Yeah. You tell them, and then they say, well, what are you going to do? Time to do that 15, 20 times. Barnes and Carl got a hold of some people, and they talked to him in the office for an hour or two. Then they invited them come have dinner with them at home, and Fine said they'd talk till 2 o'clock in the morning. And they still was asking them, well, just what does he propose to do? You see, it all worked out this morning, Rick. It all worked out. You see, Debbie's kid. You see, she had been talking about Russell, and she wrote a little thing and put it there. And then yesterday afternoon she talked a little bit, and then last night after supper she talked a little bit, and it was all changed. So by the time I read that little thing she put on there, it was out of date. What she talked about was much more interesting than what she said on the paper. And that's what I told her, that what she gets here won't affect her opinions or her principles, or she won't be committed to anything. You see, it's just a way of looking. And it was just a perfect example of it. But you can't put that down on a piece of paper. You cannot do it.
At least not so they can read it.
No.
So you've just got to make up something.
You have to see it. Or if you show them the papers. Now you see, she wrote on the same thing today, and I imagine it'll be a little more interesting. Except tonight, you see, she's gone so far ahead of the other, it's just going to be dull reading whatever she set down. So, you see, she's going to have to get a little spirit in it, you see. Well, now that's the way it works. And that's the other point that she could see. That Debbie could, I mean, it was visible, so... visible, you see, from that last night, is, you see, she done all these things, but she don't know what she's done. She doesn't have control of it. She doesn't have the use of it. And you see, if she starts with the highly artistic forms, so. Short stories or poems or things like that, she don't know what to do. So what she'll do is she'll sit there and chew a pencil and smoke and drink coffee and be nervous. Now that's what they all do. It just makes them nervous. And what this fellow up there says, he says the one thing they don't do, he says once they learn all this, the one thing they don't do is write.
Uh-huh.
I'd kill him. Uh-huh. It'd kill him to write, you uh-huh. see. Well, you see, I see a little, you see. I learn a little bit from everybody, anybody, you know, where I have a chance. I don't make it up, you see, but I can listen, you see. I can get into it. I learn from yours. You see, you need those minor forms. You need those intermediate forms. You need to be a second and third grade. You don't want to start in college. And you see, if you start right, everything you do, you look at it in your typewriter, and it's refreshing to you.
Mm-hmm.
It enables you to breathe easier. And you don't want to stay tanked up with coffee and tobacco. You don't. You go out and get some fresh air. While these kids up there on the campus, a little fresh air would kill them. It just wouldn't agree with them. When they get outside, they breathe they don't breathe deep. They get too much air. I don't know what sort of place that is, Debbie. Bad enough
with you.
Here.
What's it like?
Yeah, you see, here they don't have any background. Most of the people do come out and have a little background. Well, you see, there's two things right there. You see, that you pick up out here, you could pick that up at the dime store, or you don't. And after you come out here, it's not immediate. Mm-mm. You gotta.
It isn't.
It's just like what Marcus said, you know, the whole thing's a matter of attitude. It ain't any rules to it. It's something intangible. You see, just like this other. You look at it. Well, David said she was doing something technically today, and I said, all right, but I wouldn't do much of it because she got a running start now. She got a way of writing that works.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't meddle with it. Be plenty of time to meddle. If you got something that will carry you through France or mm-hmm. carry you through Russia.
Don't meddle with your rhetoric.
Just go ahead. Except, you see, what you did tonight on Korska there just puts the other to shame. So, you will normally adapt your... Mm-hmm. your
yeah, it mm-hmm. will.
That's right. You'll normally adapt. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. We've talked. Did you realize that? You were bringing Korska really tough to life?
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot livelier than it was. She knows what she's doing. And she knows when she's not doing it, too.
I know, and I'm not doing it. Yeah, I sure do.
You never know when you're going to take off for another month or two.
Well, I'm not taking off anywhere.
I see, whatever it is, I don't know. But for me, I'd rather do this than anything I would in. But you see, those two flatheads, they go off and leave that poor, that all those innocent things. After they find it, they go off and leave it. So you got...
Debbie, I tell you, you may not know when things are lighting up, but if you could watch yourself, you could see, you know, you can almost see your mind taking hold and going to something else.
Okay.
Well.
Well, it's too bad it's raining right now.
How hard is it raining?
It's trying to walk out.
I think it's raining too hard.
It's not raining too
hard.
Yeah, I gotta put some stuff out here.